Silly Conversations, the podcast. Your host, Denzel Mills.
So, ladies and gentlemen, again, this series of me talking to and chatting to people who have made a life here in Spain or in Valencia, and another person who has many talents, I think, many talents, is also on this chat today. So it's another native speaker, Mike. He's going to introduce himself and he'll tell you a little bit about what he does. And then we'll get into the general conversation. So Mike, first of all, thank you very much for your time.
Oh, not at all. Thank you for having me, Denzel.
Busy man. So thank you very much for your time. Basically, just give us a little outline of who you are, and then we can take it from there with some questions and answers and conversation.
Oh, that's a difficult question to answer, but I must say, I know that your listeners are learners of English, many of them very advanced, and what springs to mind is the idiom, jack of all trades, master of none. Yeah, so much good talent, as it were. But I do have, shall we say, interests that I pursue, many of them. I am someone who wants to be of use, a little bit over-earnest in that regard, I dare say.
Yeah.
I like to be a useful citizen. I like to be a useful member of the communities that I belong to, every level, and that includes international, I think, right down to local, and particularly family. I think that I would start there, and that's what enables me to do things, to be of use and useful as opposed to its opposite. I must confess that your very kind description of me is perhaps not as accurate as it might be, and I wouldn't consider myself talented anyway. I do work at things. And the reason for that is that I pursue beauty. What carries me through is beauty and truth, and I get extremely energized and sparked by seeing people prevail over difficulties. I love to be of help. For some reason, I was drawn to teaching, and I know that I teach the whole person. I always do that in whatever circumstances.
Can I stop you there? When you said, I like to teach the whole person, can you kind of describe that in an easier way for people to kind of catch the idea of teaching the whole person?
Yeah, perhaps I should contrast the role of teaching the person with the role of teaching to a particular test, which has great value.
Right.
It can help. It can change people's life chances. You get a qualification. I mean, look who I'm talking to. You excel at this. You prepare students to
excel.
Okay. All right, perhaps I don't mean to overact, but let's say that you're going to do a sterling job with whoever is in your care.
I like that phrase, sterling job. This is very British. This is a very British phrase, but more English, actually, a more English phrase. Very sterling job, yes.
Yeah, that's lovely. I guess that's part of my character armor, I must confess. I'll say that I don't mind making myself vulnerable. I do wear language. I use language as a tool. But to go back to that definition, teaching the whole person by accompanying them on a journey that is as much emotional, and that's in terms of managing their reactions,
right,
as it is, shall we say, focused and disciplined, doing the homework, copying down vocabulary at the right time, and so on and so forth.
Well, then how do you find that? Because I can understand that definition or that statement when we're talking about being a parent or working with younger children. But most of us, you and me, we both work with teenagers, people in their early 20s, and in my case, quite a lot of adults. How does that thinking apply to that age group, that kind of 18 to 35?
Yeah, well, it applies in many ways, none of them scientific. I don't profess to be scientific about this, yet I do feel that looking back and footprints show a trail of results. And it's not only to my own footprints, I think it's elsewhere. To start with, the big word would be the word rapport. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I establish rapport, and that means dealing with individuals and matching them. The next part, I must confess, I get this from my artistic pursuits. in my teens, one of the greatest opportunities that I've ever had. And I'm so grateful for this. And I got the chance to join the National Youth Theatre of Great Britain.
Okay.
Now, what I learned, however, about teamwork and preparing a production was during improvisation work workshops. We would use the material by a man called Keith Johnston. Very simple idea of status games, higher and lower, and that all transactions, social interaction, the drama comes from status. Now, that applies in the classroom, sort of fast forwarding. I did a tour of masters, and the tutor, he said that he was very fond of suggestopedia. Now, there's a technique, not scientific. Yeah.
No, but I've heard this concept of this idea of suggestion, and use it quite a lot in psychology as well, this idea of suggestion, but suggestopedia. Okay, nice word.
Well, what I take from it, very similar to what Michelle Thomas does, you know, that it's that you put the student in a high status position. That is to say, you lower your status, so you're slightly below, and then you feed them the language that they need.
Yeah.
So you need the rapport, you need the trust. That's not going to happen without that emotional connection.
Yeah.
And that has to be earned. And so that's how I am teaching the whole person. And that's how it works with adults.
And I think this, the word you say is teaching them the language that they need.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing, because you and I, we've both worked in academies, and the academy says, okay, this is the material we're going to use. Mm-hmm. And the material starts at this.
Yes.
Regardless whether that person is going to be traveling to a business event, doing a presentation, or just going to a wedding or going on holiday, the book starts at this point. And if that information, that vocabulary, and those structures are connected to what that person needs, you're very, very lucky. The reality is 99% of the time, it has no connection to what that person needs.
Yes.
And I think that's the point. Starting with what they actually need. And also, I think you actually get gains. People walk away and they leave and they walk away thinking, oh, maybe I can apply this, or let me see if I can try and apply this. And that's, for me, the most important thing.
I think that any conscientious teacher is going to personalize and also supplement whatever's in a book. The contents of the book, I'm sure, in terms of structure, vocabulary, is going to be of value, certainly. Whether or not the presentation is engaging, it tends to be the most important thing these days, which I find totally questionable. You know, I really think that that's, it's like that concept of gamification. There's something terribly patronizing about that. You know, it's used in the...
You'll hate me in a classroom then.
Well, I love games. I'm not against games and fun. Again, it's about context.
I think, like I said, I think it's about personality. I mean, I would never try to insist, if I'm working with somebody, to work in my style. People do employ me, and people employ you and have employed you because of your style of working. And with some people, it connects fantastically. With others, it doesn't. And I'm very clear with people I work with to say, this is how I work. And I don't mind if you decide, oh, I prefer to go with another teacher, another provider, because at the end of the day, we are building this kind of relationship. And if you are a person who is very, let's say, structured way of thinking, you've experienced learning a language in that particular way, and you want to continue, then I'm really not your kind of person. The Michelle Thomas approach, which I've listened to, I actually think is really cool.
Yeah, so do I. Very nice. We can go further in the classroom, of course, much further.
Yeah.
You know,
if you want to look up listeners or whoever, if you want to look up Michelle Thomas and his teaching approach, which was very much aimed at getting people up to, how can I say, a working level. When I say working level, not to be proficient in their job, but in terms of a working communication level for travel, for business, etc. Worked quite a lot with business executives and get them up to a level where what they actually needed, the vocabulary, the structures, what they actually needed was paramount to everything else.
Absolutely. May I just add to that a little, just give a practical example? I certainly have got content that I'm going to cover. And What I need to do in every situation is to make a judgment, responsible, professional judgment about the likely needs. And of course, I'm going to involve the student and students in that. But I'll also go before, because my perspective may well be better informed in right. terms of challenges and obstacles. I might spot some areas that might otherwise be omitted. And the interesting ways, for example, I'm very excited about the next semester's teaching, because I've been preparing. I mentioned Shakespeare earlier, and I do have a wonderful 14-year-old daughter. We've been reading and talking. We've been reading 1984, and I was shocked at what I was seeing. Mm-hmm. To be honest, it's been so long since I read it. My point, and regarding the next semester and teaching and application to classroom, is this. Quotes, yeah? Many of my students, in fact, all of my students, are going to be using English for various functions and aspects of business.
Right.
Very advanced, proficient level. And I've been finding quotes which are very applicable. For example, heavy the head that wears the crown, that kind of, I hope I haven't butchered the quote, but there we are. I need to look it up and check. That's a little thing to double check. But getting quotes, getting simple definition, and then an application to a situation. This is a wonderful stimulus for discussion.
Right.
And the insight that this brings is manifold, because, again, it involves the whole person. Because these young people are preparing to be ethical citizens and ethical professionals. There you go, being useful. That's what inspires me, you see, to be part of that. That's just beautiful.
When you said, because you talked about 1984, which is the George yes. Orwell book. If you're curious to find out, 1984, George Orwell. So, Mike, you're a teacher, but you also do something else, which I've seen you several times or many times with your band and the group that you actually play with. So your life as a musician, did it start before you came to Valencia, or was it in the UK?
Oh, it started way before. My brother knew that I wanted to play guitar. My brother, who was working in marketing in Mexico City, sent me the money to get the guitar, and that was wonderful. It had special value for me. And I would sit, and again, like a language, I could start picking out things that I was hearing from favorite players across a range of styles.
So did you start learning via listening or hearing yeah. rather than learning the chords?
I would say, well, definitely the former, mm-hmm. by listening. And I would even say I started learning before I even had an instrument. When right. I improvise now, I used to think I'm just improvising and making up all these lines. Actually, I believe it's recall. I think it's through singing along to various things in my, you know, pieces, enjoyed and played over and over and again on vinyl. I think that that ingrained these sounds in my memory, and I can just recall them. So there'd be phrases, whole phrases. Yeah. So I started learning that, and they fit. It also defined my taste as well.
Right.
Well, and my taste tends to be pretty, to be honest.
Yeah. Just before we get onto your tastes of music, one of the things I really miss with the whole CDs, and now it's MP3s and downloads, etc., with a vinyl album.
The album cover, isn't it? It's going to be the album
exactly,
cover.
Exactly. Yes, it was the album cover, but also you used to read you could read the liner notes.
That's it. Yeah, I thought so.
And the artists, you know, and the musicians. And sometimes you will buy. I've done this many times. I've looked at an album in a record shop, and I thought, oh, it's got this guy, Paulino Di Costa, percussion. Yes. It's got George Duke on
that's
bass.
It, yeah.
And you don't know the singer, but you've looked at the musicians, and you think, well, if all these musicians are with this singer, it's got to be good. And that's one of the things I actually miss. You miss understanding or knowing who are the artists.
Yes.
Or who are the musicians behind the artists. Because that indicates sometimes a lot when it's a new artist, and maybe you've never heard of this person before, but you look at the liner notes, you look at the musicians, and you think, if all these people are working with this person, it's got to be good.
Absolutely.
It's got to be
that's
good.
That's exactly it. That's exactly, that echoes my experience to a T. I did exactly the same thing. And sometimes it would mean apparently crossing styles.
Yep.
Yeah. For example, one key figure here would be Stan Getz.
Yeah.
Because he worked with small group swing. That's the music I most enjoy. He helped the sound of bossa nova go international. And in fact, that's what I really like. I love the Brazilian sound. But
just explain a little bit what swing is. I've got younger people. Wait. We're still young, but we're not that young. So what's swing music? A quick definition of swing music.
First thing I'll say is that there was an era known as the swing era. Mm-hmm. And I suppose it was towards the later part of the 1930s.
Right.
And of course, America was pretty isolationist. Swing was about money, to be honest, because it brought dancers in.
Right.
And they danced really well. And I do like, I love a lot of the sound, and I'm sure it's all sincere. I really do. But there were people behind the scenes who were making music that was challenging and beautifully structured, and perhaps even more lively, joyful, and exuberant, but who were less known. I'll name a couple of names. On one hand, there's Benny Goodman.
Right, yeah.
Brilliant, and I don't mean any harm. And also what they did socially, going against the grain. They broke social norms by having multiracial bands. That wasn't without its cost.
So just putting in the context, remember, we're talking about America, 1930s, 40s, and 50s.
Late 30s. Just
and obviously that, there was still a lot of segregation in the United States, especially in the South, where a lot of this music started and came up. And basically, you had black musicians creating a sound and style of music, really, for the white audience, basically, to put it this
maybe,
way.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not. It's a bit complicated. The American situation being so blatantly racialized. They had race labels, record labels for whites and for blacks. And they were quite okay of it. In fact, they even encouraged race pride, which is, I find it totally bizarre and very different to the UK. And I think the ugly part came after the war, I would say.
Yeah, but that was kind of the birth or the start of a style of music like swing. We had blues, and then it kind of came into jazz, as most people know. And I think now there's a lot of people who do, what's it called? Lindy hop dancing. They do a lot of Lindy hop. So if you're not too sure what swing music is, but if you do Lindy hop or you've heard of Lindy hop or you're thinking about it, it's kind of in that category, if I'm correct, yeah?
Yeah, I think one needs a good reference. I think I would go to the source, and I would say that for dance, the classic swing feel is an even boom, 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 short notes, boom, 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 at that.
Right.
And yes, indeed, Benny Goodman and his band, etc., had it, and everyone could agree. Some of it was layered in ways that got extremely exciting. And that's where what I would call the superior bands, I would say. I'm thinking of the Jimmy Lunceford Orchestra. There is a video, a live video of the band Jimmy Lunceford Orchestra performing Nagasaki. And so you've got on top of, you've got horn sections and a vocalist doing what is effectively rap. Freedom against, just like early Louis Armstrong, rhythmic freedom against that. And it's so infinitely more nuanced than the packaged swing sound that's used by dancers. And this is where I'm going to go a little bit further and say that to my tastes, not that I'm a stickler for authenticity, it's just that I do like things to taste right. What happened is that boom, 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 regular beat devolved into something heavier and with a lengthened first one like this, boom ba boom ba boom ba doom ba doom ba doom ba, akin to dooby dooby doo, the stereotype, that. And this loping sound is what we tend to hear for the dancers of the modern age, where dance is the important thing. You know, the same thing, it is lovely.
We talked about this idea of starting from, or your interest starting from swing, and then you've moved, gravitated, I like this word, gravitated to the kind of bossa nova style. Yeah?
Yes.
If I'm correct, yeah?
Yeah. I think that the music, that the beat, that the flow must come from within. And then it's put through a discipline which can be shared
So then going back to what you were saying about your interest in bossa nova, because I know you play, I know you sing. So what did you need to learn or to develop to, I know you said you learn very well by listening. So I'm supposed there was quite a lot of listening to the Brazilian sound, et cetera, and practicing. Now, retrospectively, did you have any particular technique which helped you absorb or hear better that sound so you can repeat it when you're playing in your sessions, in your gigs?
Retrospectively, the decisive moment was simply watching a flute player, a man called Loose Tubes. He was really nice and helpful to me, but I would pester him. And he was sitting around, we'd been listening to wine, listening to records, as it were, and he just asked me for a pencil and paper. He said, put that on again, and he listened, and he wrote out the chord symbols and wrote out a rhythm, and just watching how he could just do this by ear. He wrote out what the chord was. He had a reference. He did it all by ear. I didn't see his ear operating, of course, but I could see what was going on. And I asked him, how did you do that? And he says, well, you should learn to read music. That's one thing. When I could start to identify the important parts, I could focus on different things. Previously, I was unable to refer to the harmony. I would listen just to the melody and also to a kind of beat,
right,
a general beat. But later, I could see how the harmony also had rhythm.
You heard, mm-hmm. but at the time, when you were hearing this and enjoying it, you didn't actually know technically what it was. You just...
Absolutely
it,
so.
It kind of just it hit you and you thought, I love yes. this sound, or I like this way it makes me feel.
Yes.
I didn't know the technical term for it, in a sense.
Exactly. Yeah, and I'll be honest, I'll go further than that. Now, I'm studying music all the time. In fact, at the moment, I'm busy using free software, which is incredible. You know, MuseScore, it's wonderful. Notation program. And writing for a six-piece and swing stuff, yeah?
Right.
So that I could just hand the music to these amazing trained guys that just read whatever you put in front of them. So we can quickly get to the fun part, you know. Nowadays, I'm using it for practical purposes.
But just going back a little bit in general, when we talk about this autonomous learning and relating it to work, our work, sometimes I find people so lazy. It's easier for them to say to me, what does this mean? And they've got a phone. Now you just ask Google or Apple or whatever. You know, you don't even have to write it. You can dictate the word into a phone and it will give you the translation, and it will give you a definition, and it will give you examples of how it's used. But still, there are people who are so lazy, they'll just say, oh, I don't know what this word means. And, yes. and sometimes it's after, how can I say, maybe something in the material that we've used or part of the conversation. Now, I'm not really a big advocate that people... they're always on their telephones and not paying attention, because for me, that kind of just basically pisses me off big time.
Yes.
Okay, I'll put it this way.
Yes.
But there's a level of laziness now, whereas in the past, when people had dictionaries, I remember the old dictionaries, people.
Absolutely.
Dictionaries were these kind of books with pages, and they had all the words, and you had to go through alphabetically to find the word that you need, and then it will tell you, I'd give you a description of that word. Dictionaries were so good. Realistically, if you don't have a dictionary, even if you're a language learner, it doesn't matter the language, buy a dictionary, a small one. Use a dictionary. And the very fact that you've got this thing with a list of words, you'll see the words before and the words after. And out of curiosity, you will just continue looking at these words. So Google and... new tech is fine because it can give you a very quick definition in that moment. Believe me, buy yourself a dictionary and I can guarantee you'll just have a better time learning words, because words will just come up, the very fact that you've just gone through, and you'll see the definitions and you'll see whether it's a noun or whatever, a verb or transitive verb. It will actually help you develop this curiosity and this self-learning rather than just accepting and waiting for me or Mike or whoever to tell you what the definition is.
Very important advice.
Yeah,
there.
And I think that's that part of that self-learning. I think people are losing this because everything is so easy.
A lot of dictionaries, and they're not the first version, have to update over the years as well. Always tend to say with Collins, or Bayard for French. But anyway, big books, etc., and they're gone. The online dictionaries are fine. I think it's what you do with them. Another step, if I could be so bold, would be to record in your own handwriting, preferably color-coded, pencil and pen, maybe.
Right.
Dictionary book.
Well, this is one thing Spanish students do very well when they kind of take their notes and things like that. You know, I've seen some people do schemes of work. And I've seen them do some schemes of work, and it's like a work of art. So this is something that people really do very, very well. I think they actually lose it once they start working. So as students, I think they have it. And then maybe when they actually start working, it's something, it just kind of disappears. But I think that's one way of actually...
Yeah, I know. You mentioned, touched on something yourself just now, which is really important. And I wish I prepared this, because the last thing I want to do is to misinform. So I'll be careful. There are different forms of visual representation. There was the gentleman responsible for conceiving and popularizing mind map, Tony Buzan. But then there's planning. I have actually used mind mapping very successfully during lectures.
Yeah.
And it's very colorful mind mapping. And then I went to recording onto audio, referring to books, etc. And then I'd type up from the audio. That was very useful for a whole course of study.
Right.
That was very, very useful for me. But nowadays, I prefer to keep everything in my head. I need to understand the idea. And if I can look up data, I don't store that. But I need to understand the processes involved.
Yeah, I'm very much the opposite. I kind of do I'm kind of the listening and observation style. That's my style of learning. Observation and listening rather than the kind of reading or mind maps, etc. I remember when I used to design training courses, management training courses in the UK. And it was maybe a subject area that I wasn't very skilled in, like finance for non-financial managers. And you kind of want to get the basic idea how to pull something together so then you can design the course and obviously bring in a specialist in that area. And I tried this whole mind mapping thing. It was the fashion at the time. I got so lost. I just got so lost. I don't have that kind of logical kind of approach. I just got so lost. But anyway, a couple of things you actually said, because you talked about the dictionaries. Now somebody is drilling. I don't know if this is going to come across. How many languages do you speak? Or can you communicate in well?
I did my first degree was in modern languages, with French and Spanish. Before I started, I was already able to understand Brazilian Portuguese,
right,
having obsessed over those same Bossa Nova records. I suppose I can converse in it to some degree. You see, I understand, I've memorized, in terms of songs, I have at least 300 sets of lyrics memorized.
Right.
And I know the harmony for most of them, and they all fit into different categories.
Well, this is in Portuguese, yeah?
This in matches English and Portuguese.
Right.
In Portuguese, I suppose it's under 30, about 30. In terms of what do I know? Yeah, I mean, I can speak and converse pretty fluently in French, Spanish. My French is pretty good, surprisingly. I still get the opportunity to use it. So French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese. My mother was German. I never studied the grammar. I did live there and teach there for a while. I could speak okay. I could understand everything and make my needs met. But
obviously, so you've learned some formally by the interest in terms of music. And I suppose you've learned some languages, like maybe German, just by exposure. Is there a common thread or a technique which you try to apply or pass on to people you're teaching and working with?
Yes, there is, absolutely. And I have it kind of down to, not exactly a fine art, but I've got it down to a repeatable, and I think this is important, it's worth saying, but I think I have it down to a repeatable flow of steps.
Right.
And those steps could be refined and personalized. One could even subdivide them. And that way, step one, step two, step three, just as one would with how to brush one's teeth. Yeah.
Yeah.
Starting with pick up a brush, maybe moisten it to open the the tap or forceps, whichever is your hair, you know, remove the cap from the toothpaste. It may be pedantic and literal, but I would go to those degrees, yeah, of refinement.
If you were teaching maybe an absolute beginner or pre-intermediate, give us a little example to kind of like maybe, you know, step by step.
Well, I mean, to be honest, for absolute beginners, I mean, nothing beats the Berlitz method. You know, I don't think I'm okay. So this is great for audio, isn't it? Well, so I can't show visuals, but let's imagine. I'm sure we could imagine. Let's say, let me just choose some objects. I have pen, cup, and mobile phone. Pen, cup, and mobile phone. So I need some first principles, and that is that nothing that I'm introducing here is beyond the lived experience of the person whom I'm teaching, okay?
Right.
And I've got the rapport, friendly, everyone is your friend kind of thing. Okay, so, and I'm going to start, in French, yeah? I'm going to say, bic, bic, and I'm holding up a pen, and it actually has the word bic on it, because that's the brand,
yep? Yeah.
Bic, bic, and I wave and gesture, bic, and I nod, and encourage you to say it, bic, bic, and I'm hoping that Denzel's going to play with me. Is he going to respond, bic?
Beak, beak.
And now in a questioning intonation, I'm holding up the mobile phone and go, beak, beak, oui ou non?
No.
No, aha. You see, so we've already established something. Now, that way, we'll say what something is, what it isn't. And then eventually, I'll go, beak, oui?
Beak, oui.
Oui, good. And then I'll say, qu'est-ce que c'est? Qu'est-ce que c'est? And I'm hoping that he's going to actually produce the word.
Beak.
Good. And then we'll add to it. C'est un bic, etc., etc. C'est un stylo, or whatever it's going to be. I don't know why I started with bic, because I saw it on there.
But, yeah, but you still remember your Berlitz method, eh?
Oh, yeah, because there's three levels of distinction. You see, what we're doing is actually passing on the agency. Now, what is important here, of course, and this is where the grown-ups enter the room, yeah? The whole person enters the room. You know, it depends what we aspire to be and who we are. There's a great deal to this, and perhaps I'm a little over-intense in this regard, but I'm afraid I do question, and I think that it's essential to do this so that there is meaning and value to what we do. I'm assuming that people want to interact, that they want to contribute, and that's the reason for communication,
right,
to have their needs met and so forth. So we're dealing here with the pragmatics of language, and that's where we get the functional language in our course books,
yeah,
giving directions, ask, et cetera, et cetera. And personalizing it, creating, challenging the students to rise to the challenge of a very likely situation in their own experience. So
yeah,
my basis would be I would then situate the practice, controlled practice, in a context that would be personal to the students. My main priority there would be to ensure that there are no bad habits. So
yeah,
that's where the work is going to be. I'd separate the spoken from the written. I take great care to encourage good punctuation habits in English, which are very poorly taught. And I've never seen a single EFL or ESOL book that deals with it. The Americans deal with it pretty well, on the other hand.
But when you say punctuation, in
yeah,
terms of what sense? In terms of the written sense or in terms
I'm
of spoken?
About written. Well, okay, actually both. I didn't mean punctuation with spoken, but now that you raise it, yes, the tone unit and tone
right,
boundaries, and how through the prosodic features of language we can signal, you know, we can slow down to speed up. And this
right,
is an important factor, something that can be taught, when to pause, etc. I was referring, however, to written.
Yeah.
At, you know, just using a comma to join two independent clauses.
Yeah.
That kind of thing in informal writing does not reflect well. And in international context, it's not a good thing.
Yeah.
That has to be
nipped. But I just think part of that comes from also the foundation language. I mean, sometimes when I'm looking at some people's work or preparation for exams, and they've got sentences which are like 10,000 words long, you know. And even in Spanish, when you see it in Spanish and you read something and you think, where is the comma, where is the full stopping? So I think this is one of these things which filters into or filters through the base language and how then people actually communicate written in
English.
Yeah,
that's a rich yeah, vein to mine, to be yeah, honest, because I think that there's greater tolerance in the home language in the first language. I think it's incumbent on teachers to raise this, but it has to be done. So
let's try to start to wrap this up because, you know, you can hear the Valencia life here happening in the background. So generally speaking, how's your life here? Because I, like I said, for me, this is home. I class this place as home. I don't know, for you, how do you sum up your Spain, Valencia situation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's not over till it's over and it's sort of ongoing. But as with any relationship, it's forever for me. I don't go in lightly. And it's not my first time in Spain. I came in the mid-80s. My wife and I decided to, what's the word? There's a buzzword for this. What's the word? To downsize, I suppose.
Downsize, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Live more simply. And in that regard, I mean, we've never looked back. The health, the calm pace of life, hung trees outside the window, the sun every day just breeds certain optimism. So just being around this and facing each day and being present, that's something. Then also relationships with people. I have an in automatically through music, right. And I like to play with people with whom I get on. So first I try and get on with them, and then we develop a project. Is there some trust? And I tend to play with the same people, different styles of music, and that's working out beautifully. And then our daughter, socially, I mean, it's amazing. She gets on with so many different types of people. She's multilingual. She also has friends who are just so well brought up. And so, again, it's that old saying,
important.
Show me your friends, I'll tell you who you are. You know, I'm just delighted that she's in with such a nice group of people, you know. So, yeah, very happy there.
Tell people where they can find your band. Like I said, it's not a big audience, but there may be one or two people who would like to see you play, interested in the type of music. So take this opportunity. But where can people find out about your band and when you're playing out? And have you got anything coming up in the next few months?
The opportunity to do that. For me, that means small venues, a little place, and preferably the people who like it. So I play a little wine bars, and there is a small club. It's Vishu, that's Jimmy Glass. Every so often, you see Mike McCoy, da-di-da-di-da, etc. One of the bands that I have is called Remembering Gets Gilberto, which is literally, we play the arrangements of Bossa Nova that became famous as one. The other is myself and a particular friend who plays tenor saxophone, and he's just incredible. He's a member of a phenomenally musical family. His name is Juanjo Martin.
Yeah.
So Juanjo Martin and myself play as a duo around the wine bars. And there's a place called Da Capo. I'll be there in, I think, October. The Da Capo in Benimaclet, wine bar, or Vinoteca Da Capo. The other, the Cafe Mercedes, which hasn't been open for some time.
Not Mercedes, no. Remember you were playing I saw you once in a small little wine bar just
that was gorgeous, that place. We held that gig down weekly for well over a year, about 18 months. Unfortunately, they had to sell up. The owner's family, etc. He needed to return to Italy. That was the most beautiful situation. We were playing every week there. No, also because of my other responsibilities, I can't play every week, but I'm constantly preparing and working on music. The place that I'm thinking of, it's called La Viti.
La Viti. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to be there with two outfits. One involves Juanjo again. And this is a band called Soul Samurai.
That was my interview with Mike McCoy. I apologize for the abrupt ending. We had a few technical issues because we're so professional. But you can check out his band, Mike McCoy and Soul Samurai, at venues in Valencia. And hopefully you enjoy the band. Hopefully you enjoyed the conversation. And I'll see you on the next one. This was Denzel at Silly Conversations.
The voices and the names have been changed in this podcast to protect the wicked. For any grammar, information, or correction, please ask someone else, not me.